As for the head, leaving it as nothing but naked bone was impossible, given how far the seasons swing toward heat at one extreme and toward cold at the other, nor again to let it become muffled in flesh, and so dull and unfeeling. Since the fleshy substance did not dry out completely, a larger rind formed and separated off from it, what is now called skin. This, because of the moisture around the brain, drew together into itself, and sprouting in a circle, clothed the head all around. And as the wetness climbed up beneath the seams, it irrigated the skin and pulled it shut at the crown, gathering it, as it were, into a knot. The varied pattern of the sutures came about through the power of the revolutions and of nutrition, being more numerous where these forces conflicted more with one another, and fewer where they conflicted less. The divine power then pricked this whole skin all around with fire, and once it was pierced and the moisture carried outward through it, whatever was pure moisture and heat departed, while the mixed part, of which the skin itself was made, was lifted by the current and stretched out long outside, having a thinness equal to the puncture. But being slow, it was pushed back inward under the skin by the surrounding outer air and took root there coiled up. And it is by these processes that the class of hairs has grown in the skin, being akin to it as a strap is akin to leather, but harder and denser through the compacting effect of the cold, which each hair, once it separates from the skin, undergoes as it cools and is compressed together. By this means, the maker made our heads shaggy, using the causes stated, but intending that this should serve as a covering instead of flesh, for the safety of the brain, being light, and providing adequate shade and shelter in both summer and winter, while posing no obstacle to keenness of sensation. As for the interlacing of sinew, skin, and bone in the region of the fingers, once mixed from the three and dried out, it became one common hard substance, skin of a sort, produced by these contributing causes, but wrought for the sake of the most decisive purpose, namely what was to come afterward. For those who were putting us together knew that women and the other animals would one day come to be from men, and they also knew that many of the creatures would need the use of claws for many purposes. Hence, in human beings, right from birth, they sketched out the growth of nails. It is on this reasoning, and for these ends, that, out at the tips of the limbs, they made skin and hair and nails spring forth. Once all the parts and limbs of the mortal living being had grown together, and it necessarily had to have its life amid fire and breath, and for this reason was wasting away, being melted and drained by these, the gods contrived help for it. Blending a nature akin to human nature with other forms and other kinds of sensation, so that it would be a different living thing, they planted it, what are now the tame trees, plants, and seeds, trained by agriculture to be gentle toward us, although in earlier times nothing existed but the untamed varieties, which predate the domesticated sorts. For whatever partakes of life may most rightly and justly be called a living thing, and what we are now speaking of does participate in that third form of soul, the one our account places in the region between the navel and the midriff, a kind that has no part whatsoever in opinion, reasoning, or understanding, but only in sensation, pleasant and painful, together with desires. For it remains passive throughout, and since it was turned in upon itself, around itself, repelling motion from without and using only its own, its birth did not grant it the nature to observe and reason about any of its own experiences. Hence it lives, and is not other than a living thing, but it stands fixed, rooted and stationary, because it is deprived of motion by itself. Having planted all these kinds to be food for us, their inferiors, the higher powers channeled our body itself, cutting it through with conduits as one cuts channels in a garden, so that it might be watered as if by an incoming stream. And first they cut two hidden channels beneath the junction of skin and flesh, two veins along the back, twin as the body itself happens to be, right and left. These they let down along the spine, taking the generative marrow between them, so that it might flourish as much as possible, and so that the flow, since it ran downhill from there to everything else, might provide an even supply of water. After this, splitting the veins around the head and weaving them crosswise through one another, they sent them down, steering those on the right over to the body's left flank, and bending the left-hand ones across to the right, so that there might be a bond, together with the skin, linking the head to the body, since the head was not encircled by sinews at the crown, and also so that the experience of the senses from both sides might be made evident to the whole body. From this point on they arranged the conveyance of water in some such way as this, which we shall see more easily once we have first agreed on the following, that everything composed of smaller parts contains the larger, while what is composed of larger parts cannot contain the smaller, and fire is of all the kinds the one with the smallest parts, and so it passes through water, earth, air, and whatever is composed of these, and nothing can contain it. The same must be understood about our stomach. When food and drink fall into it, it contains them, but breath and fire, being of parts smaller than its own structure, it cannot contain. These then the god used for conveying water from the stomach to the veins, weaving together a network of air and fire like a fish weir, having a double funnel mouth at the entrance, one of which he further wove in two. And from these funnel mouths he stretched out, as it were, cords all around, through the hole, to the outer edges of the network. The interior parts of the woven structure he composed wholly of fire, but the funnel mouths and the outer casing of air-like material. And taking this, he arranged it around the creature he had shaped in the following manner. He let down one of the funnel mouths into the mouth, and since it is double, he let one part down through the windpipe into the lung, the other beside the windpipe into the stomach. The other funnel mouth he split, and let each part out in common through the passages of the nose, so that whenever the one through the mouth did not operate, all the currents from that one too would be replenished from this one. The rest of the hollow of the weir he wrapped around all the hollow part of our body, and made it so that this whole mass sometimes flows gently together into the funnel mouths, being air, and sometimes the funnel mouths flow back, while the network itself, since the body is porous, sinks in through it and out again, and the rays of fire within, being bound fast to it, follow the air as it goes in either direction. And this, for as long as the mortal living creature holds together, never ceases happening. And it is to this process that the one who assigned the names gave the terms inhalation and exhalation. And all this activity and experience has come to be for our body, so that, being watered and cooled, it might be nourished and live. For whenever, as the breath goes in and out, the fire bound within follows along with it, and being forever suspended, passing in through the stomach, takes hold of the food and drink, it melts them, and dividing them into small portions, conducting them out through the passages by which it travels, draws them off as if from a spring into channels leading to the veins, and sets the streams within the veins running along the body as though along a pipe. Let me turn once more to what happens in breathing, by what causes it operates in the way it now does. It is this way, since there is no void into which anything in motion could enter, and breath moves outward from us, the next point is clear to everyone, that it does not move into a void, but pushes what is next to it out of its place. And what is pushed drives out in turn what is next to it, and by this necessity everything, being driven around, follows the breath into the place from which it came out, entering there and filling it up, and this all happens at once, like a wheel turning, because there is no void anywhere. That is why the chest and the lung, in releasing breath outward, become filled again by the air around the body, which sinks in through the porous flesh and is driven around. And again, as the air turns back and passes out through the body, it forces the inhaled breath back around through the passage of the mouth and nostrils. The cause of the origin of these movements must be posited as follows. Every living creature has its inner parts, around the blood and the veins, hottest, as if it had within itself a kind of spring of fire. And this is what we compared to the weaving of the fish weir, saying that the whole of it was woven of fire stretched through the middle, and all the other, outer parts, of air. Now it must be agreed that heat naturally moves outward to its own region, toward what is akin to it. And since there are two outlets, one through the body outward, the other in turn through the mouth and nostrils. Whenever it rushes toward one, it drives the other around. And what is driven around, falling into the fire, is heated, while what goes out is cooled. And as the heat changes, and the parts at the other exit become hotter, the hotter part inclines back that way again, moving toward its own nature, and drives around what is at the other side. And since this experiences the same things and gives back the same things in return always, a circle is thus set swaying this way and that. And it is by both these movements together that inhalation and exhalation are brought about. TIMAUS, and indeed the causes of the sensations produced by medical cupping glasses, and of swallowing, and of things thrown, whatever is released and travels through the air, and whatever moves along the ground, must be traced along these same lines. Likewise, all the sounds that appear fast or slow, high or low, sometimes discordant, because of the dissimilarity of the motion they produce in us, sometimes concordant, because of similarity. For the slower sounds, moving after the faster ones, catch up with the motions of those earlier and swifter sounds, just as they are dying away and have already arrived at a state similar to their own. And when the slower sounds, arriving later, set those earlier motions moving again, they do not throw in some other disruptive motion, but rather impose the beginning of a slower movement conforming to the pattern of the faster motion as it fades, and by fitting a likeness onto it. They blend high and low into a single experience. This is what gives pleasure to the unmusical and delight to the musical, through the imitation of divine harmony that comes to exist in mortal movements. And indeed all the flows of water, and further the fall of thunderbolts, and the wonders people marvel at concerning the pull exerted by amber and by the Heraclean stone, not one of these involves any genuine attraction. Rather, since there is no such thing as void, and these things push each other around into one another's places, and as they separate and combine, each thing shifts to exchange its own seat with another. It is by these interwoven interactions that these apparent wonders will show themselves to anyone who investigates properly. And indeed, the phenomenon of breathing, from which our account set out, has come about in just this way and through these same causes, as was said before. Fire cuts up the food, and being borne along inside the body in company with the breath, it fills the veins from the belly by drawing up, through this joint motion, the matter that has been cut up there. And this is why, throughout the whole body, in all living things, the streams of nourishment flow in this manner. And these freshly cut portions, being akin to the body, some from fruits, some from greenery, which the God planted for us for this very purpose, to be nourishment, take on all sorts of colors because of their mixture, though the color that runs through them most is red, a nature produced by the cutting and wiping action of fire in moisture. TIMAUS, from this comes the color of what flows through the body, the sort of appearance we have described, which we call blood, the nourishment of the flesh and of the whole body. From it, drawing their supply, all the parts fill up whatever space has been emptied. The manner of this filling and depleting occurs just as the motion of everything in the universe occurs, whereby everything akin is born toward its own kind. For the things surrounding us on the outside are constantly dissolving us and distributing us, sending off to each kindred form what belongs to it, while the blood-filled parts within us, in turn, having been broken into small pieces inside us, and enclosed as if beneath a heaven belonging to each living creature, have no choice but to copy how the whole cosmos moves. So each of the divided parts within, moving toward its kindred substance, refills again what has just been emptied. Whenever more flows out than flows in, the whole thing wastes away. Whenever less, it grows. Now the newly formed structure of any living creature has the triangles of its elemental kinds still fresh, as it was straight from the keel blocks, and these triangles are locked tightly together with one another. Yet the whole mass of it is compacted soft, since it has only just come from marrow and has been nourished on milk. So the triangles that enter it from outside, contained within the food and drink it takes in, being older and weaker than its own triangles, are overpowered by the new ones, which cut them up, and the creature grows large as it is nourished from many similar particles. But when the root of the triangles slackens from having fought many contests over a long time against many opponents, then the incoming particles of food can no longer be cut down into a form similar to the body's own, while the body's own triangles are easily divided by those coming in from outside. Every living thing wastes away when overcome in this contest, and this condition is called old age. Finally, when the bonds holding together the triangles around the marrow no longer hold firm under the strain and come apart, they in turn release the bonds of the soul, and the soul, once freed in accordance with nature, flies off with pleasure. For anything contrary to nature is painful, while whatever happens in accordance with nature is pleasant. And death, likewise, when it comes through disease or from wounds, is painful and violent, but the death that comes with old age, reaching its end in accordance with nature, is the least distressing of deaths and comes more with pleasure than with pain. TIMAUS, as for where diseases arise from, that, I think, is clear to everyone. Since the body is packed together out of four kinds, fire, water, air, and earth, the unnatural excess or deficiency of these, and the shifting of any of them from its proper region into a foreign one, and further, since fire and the other elements each in fact occur in more than one kind, the taking on by each part of the body of a kind not proper to it, and all such things as these, produce internal conflict and disease. For when each element comes to be, or shifts, contrary to its nature, then whatever was previously cold grows hot, and what is dry later becomes moist, and things become light or heavy, and undergo every sort of change in every direction. For only, we say, when the same thing is added to and taken from the same thing, in the same manner and proportion, and in the same respect, will it be allowed to remain itself, safe and healthy. But whatever oversteps this measure in what leaves or enters from outside will produce all sorts of alterations, diseases, and countless forms of decay. Now that a second set of natural compounds has been formed, there is a second level of understanding of diseases available to anyone who wishes to grasp it. For since marrow, bone, flesh, and sinew are compounded from those first elements, and blood too, formed in a different way, but out of the same elements, most of the other diseases arise in the manner described before, but the gravest diseases prove harsh in this way, when the formation of these compounds proceeds in reverse, that is when they are destroyed. For by nature flesh and sinew arise out of blood, sinew out of the fibers, because of its kinship with them, and flesh out of what coagulates when separated from the fibers. And what departs in turn from sinews and flesh, being sticky and oily, both glues the flesh onto the substance of the bones, and also nourishes and increases the very bone that surrounds the marrow, while the part filtered through the density of the bones, the purest, smoothest, and oiliest kind of triangles, oozing and dripping from the bones, waters the marrow. And when each of these processes occurs in this way, health generally results. When it happens in the opposite way, disease results. For when flesh, wasting away, sends its wasted matter back into the veins, then blood, together with breath, abundant and of every kind, becomes mottled in the veins with colors and bitternesses, and further with sharp and salty qualities, and takes on bile of all sorts, serous fluids and phlegms of every kind. TIMAUS, for all these substances, having been formed by a reversal and corruption of the process, first destroy the blood itself, and providing no further nourishment to the body, are carried everywhere through the veins, no longer keeping the order of their natural circuits, hostile to one another, since they get no benefit from each other, and hostile too to the body's constitution, which they remain at war with, destroying it and dissolving it. Now whatever part of the flesh is oldest when it wastes, being hard to digest, turns black from long-standing charring, and because it has been eaten through everywhere, being bitter, it attacks harshly whatever part of the body is not yet corrupted. And sometimes, in place of its bitterness, the black matter takes on a sharp quality as the bitterness is refined further, while other times the bitterness, dyed by blood, takes on a redder color, and when the black is mixed with this, it becomes greenish. And further, a yellow color mixes in with the bitterness when fresh flesh is consumed by the fire around the flame. And the common name for all these substances is one that certain physicians, or perhaps someone capable of seeing, amid many dissimilar things, one single kind present in all of them worthy of a common name, have called bile, while the other kinds of bile, as they are called, have each received their own account according to their color. Serum, meanwhile, is in one form the mild way of blood, and in another the wild way of black, sharp bile, when it mixes with a salty quality through heat, and this kind is called sour phlegm. And again, what melts away together with air out of fresh, tender flesh, when this becomes windy and enveloped by moisture, and bubbles form from this condition, invisible individually because of their smallness, but together making a visible mass, having a color that looks white because of the way foam is generated, all this wasting of tender flesh, entangled with breath, we call white phlegm. And of newly forming phlegm, again, the way is sweat and tears, and all the other bodily fluids of that sort that are discharged daily in the process of purging. All these things have become instruments of disease whenever, rather than being restocked the natural way out of food and drink, the blood builds up its mass from contrary sources, contrary to the laws of nature. TIMAUS, now when each portion of flesh is broken down by disease while its foundations remain, the destructive force is only half as severe, since recovery is still possible with ease. But when the substance that binds flesh to bones falls sick, and no longer, separating itself from fibers and blood, becomes nourishment for bone and a bond for flesh to bone, but instead, from being oily, smooth, and sticky, becomes rough and salty and parched through bad regimen, then all such affected matter crumbles back again beneath the flesh and sinews, pulling away from the bones. And as it falls away from its roots, it leaves the sinews bare and full of salt, and falling back in turn into the bloodstream, it increases the number of the diseases already described. And grave as these afflictions of the body are, still graver ones precede them, when the bone, because of the density of the flesh, fails to get sufficient breathing room, and heated by mold, becomes gangrenous and can no longer take in nourishment, but instead, as it crumbles, sends its own matter in the reverse direction into that same flesh. And the flesh, falling into the blood, makes all the previous diseases rougher still. And worst of all is when the very nature of the marrow falls sick, from deficiency or some excess. This produces the gravest and most decisive of diseases, leading to death, since the whole nature of the body is forced to flow in reverse. There is, again, a third kind of disease that must be understood as arising in three ways, from breath, from phlegm, and from bile. Whenever the lung, which is steward of the breath for the body, fails to keep its passages clear, being blocked by discharges, then, since in some places no breath enters while in others more than the proper amount comes in, the parts that get no refreshment putrefy, while other parts, as the breath forces its way violently through the veins and twists them, melt the body and become trapped, enclosed as it takes hold of the midriff. And from these conditions, countless painful diseases arise, often accompanied by a great deal of sweating. Often, too, when the flesh is disrupted within the body, breath is generated there and unable to make its way out, causes the same agonies as the breath that enters from outside. Worst of all, when it surrounds the sinews and the small veins there, and swelling up, pulls the tendons and the connected sinews backward so forcefully. And it is from this very straining of the affliction that these diseases have been named tetanus and opisthotonus. For these conditions, the remedy is difficult, since fevers, once they set in on top of them, generally resolve them. The white phlegm, because of the breath trapped in its bubbles, is dangerous when shut in, but when it finds vents to the outside of the body, it is milder, though it mottles the body, producing white blotches and vitiligo, and the diseases akin to these. When mixed with black bile and spread over the circuits in the head, which are the most divine of all, it disturbs them. In sleep, this poison is gentler, but when it attacks people who are awake, it is harder to shake off. Since it is an affection of what is by nature sacred, it is most justly called the sacred disease. Sharp, salty phlegm is the source of all catarrhal diseases, and because the places into which it flows are so various, it has taken all sorts of names. All the conditions of the body that are called inflammations, from their burning and blazing, arise from bile. When bile finds a vent to the outside, boiling, it sends up all kinds of pustules. But when it is shut in, it produces many burning diseases, and the worst of these is when it mixes with pure blood and displaces the fibrous element from its proper arrangement. The fibers that are dispersed throughout the blood, so that it may have the right proportion of thinness and thickness, so that it neither flows out like a liquid through the loose flesh of the body because of heat, nor, again, becomes too thick and sluggish to circulate readily in the veins. The fibers preserve the right measure of these things by their very nature, and when someone gathers together the fibers, even of blood that is dead and has grown cold, all the rest of the blood disperses, but if they are left alone, they quickly congeal it, along with the surrounding cold. Since the fibers have this power within the blood, bile, which is by nature old blood, and has again been dissolved out of the flesh back into this state, hot and moist, when it first falls in little by little, congeals through the power of the fibers, and in congealing, being forcibly quenched, it produces internal chill and trembling. But when bile flows in more abundantly, overpowering the fibers with its own heat and setting them boiling, it shakes them into disorder, and if it manages to prevail to the end, it burns its way through to the marrow, and cutting loose the soul's cables there, as it were the mooring lines of a ship, sets it free. But when the bile is less, and the body holds out even as it wastes away, the bile itself is overpowered, and either it is expelled over the whole surface of the body, or, forced through the veins into the lower belly or the upper, it gets expelled from the body, the way a faction drives a banished man from a rebelling city, producing diarrhea and dysentery and all diseases of that kind. So a body that falls ill chiefly from an excess of fire produces continuous burning and fevers. One that falls ill from air produces quotidian fevers. One from water produces tertian fevers, since water is more sluggish than air or fire, while one from earth, being the most sluggish of the four in the fourth degree, and purged only in periods four times as long, produces quartan fevers, and is released from them only with difficulty. Such, then, is how the diseases of the body come about. As for those of the soul that arise through the condition of the body, they come about in this way. We must grant that disease of the soul is folly, and that there are two kinds of folly. One is madness, the other ignorance. Whatever affection produces either of these in a person must be called a disease, and we must set down excessive pleasures and pains as the greatest of the soul's diseases. For when a man is overjoyed, or conversely suffering under pain, hastening inopportunely to seize the one and to flee the other, he can neither see nor hear anything rightly. He is in a frenzy, and at that moment is least capable of any share in reasoning. And the man in whom seed grows abundant and fluid around the marrow, like a tree bearing more fruit than is proportionate, undergoes many pangs and gains many pleasures, one after another, in his desires, and in the offspring of such desires, and becomes for the greater part of his life frenzied because of these extreme pleasures and pains. His body renders his soul diseased and witless, and yet people reckon him not as ailing, but as deliberately depraved. But the truth is that licentiousness in matters of sex arises, for the most part, from the condition of a single substance, which, through the porousness of the bones, becomes fluid and moistening within the body, and is a disease of the soul. And indeed almost everything that is called incontinence in pleasures, and is reproached as though the wicked did wrong willingly, is not rightly reproached, for no one is willingly wicked, but the bad man becomes bad through some evil condition of the body and an unschooled upbringing, things that are hateful to everyone and come upon him against his will. And again, in the matter of pains too, the soul in the same way acquires much vice on account of the body. For whenever the sharp and salty phlegms, and all the bitter and bilious humors, wander about the body and find no vent outward, but are shut in and mix their vapor with the motion of the soul, blending with it. They produce all sorts of diseases of the soul, more or less severe, more or fewer in number, and carried to the three regions of the soul, whichever region each of them strikes, they produce varied forms of ill temper and despondency of every kind, along with assorted forms of recklessness and timidity, and likewise of poor memory and slowness at learning. Beyond this, when people so badly constituted live under bad political systems, and bad words are spoken among cities both privately and publicly, and further, when from childhood on no studies capable of curing these ills are learned, it is in this way that all of us who are bad become so through two causes entirely beyond our will, and the blame for this must be laid on the begetters more than the begotten, and on those who raise more than those who are raised. Still one must strive, so far as one is able, through upbringing and through pursuits and studies, to escape vice and to lay hold of its opposite. But this belongs to another kind of discourse. Now the converse of this, the treatment of bodies and minds by which they are preserved, it is fitting and proper to give in return, since it is more just to give an account of good things than of bad. Everything good is beautiful, and the beautiful is not without proportion. So a living creature that is to be such must be set down as well proportioned. Now we perceive small instances of proportion and reason about them, but the most sovereign and greatest instances we treat without reasoning at all. For with regard to health and disease, and virtue and vice, no proportion or disproportion is greater than that between the soul itself and the body itself. Yet we give no thought to this, and take no notice of it, that whenever a strong and altogether great soul is carried by a weaker and lesser bodily form, or when conversely, the two are joined together the other way about, the whole living creature is not beautiful, for it is out of proportion in the most important proportions of all. Whereas the creature in the opposite condition is, to one able to behold it, the most beautiful and lovely of all sights. Just as a body that is disproportionately long in the leg, or has some other excess out of measure, is at once unsightly, and also, in the exertions it must share, produces much fatigue and many cramps, and falls through its lack of balance, causing itself countless troubles. The same must be thought true of the combination of the two we call a living creature, whenever the soul within it, being stronger than the body, is overly spirited, it shakes the whole body through from within and fills it with diseases, and whenever it pursues some course of learning or inquiry too intensely, it wastes the body away. And again, when it engages in teaching and disputation in public, and in private through arguments carried on in strife and rivalry, it sets the body ablaze and shakes it loose, and by inducing discharges, it deceives most so-called physicians into blaming the wrong causes. And conversely, when a body too big and too powerful for its soul is yoked to a slight and feeble intelligence, since there are by nature two kinds of desire in human beings, one for food on account of the body, the other for wisdom on account of what is most divine in us, the motions of the stronger part prevail, and increasing what belongs to themselves, make the soul's part dull, slow to learn, and forgetful, and so bring about the greatest disease of all, ignorance. There is one safeguard against both these dangers, neither to move the soul without the body, nor the body without the soul, so that, each defending against the other, they may become evenly balanced and healthy. So the man who is working hard at mathematics or any other intense study of the mind must also give his body its due exercise by taking part in gymnastics, and the man who is carefully molding his body must in turn render to the soul the motions proper to it, by cultivating music and philosophy in every form, if he is to be rightly called at once beautiful and good. And these same parts of the body must be looked after in the same way, in imitation of the form of the universe as a whole. For since the body is heated and cooled within by the things that enter it, and again dried and moistened by things from outside, and undergoes the consequent effects from both these kinds of motion, then, whenever a person surrenders his body to these motions in a state of rest, it is overpowered and perishes. But if a person imitates that which we called the nurse and wet nurse of the universe, and above all never allows the body to remain at rest, but keeps it moving and by constantly producing certain tremors in it wards off, in accordance with nature, the internal and external motions, and by shaking it in due measure, brings into orderly arrangement, according to their affinities, the affections and parts that wander about the body, following the account we gave earlier concerning the universe as a whole. Then he will not allow enemy to be set beside enemy and breed wars and diseases in the body, but will bring about health by setting friend beside friend. Now among motions, the finest is the kind a thing sets going in itself by its own agency, since it bears the closest kinship to the movement of intellect and to that of the cosmos. Motion produced by another is worse, and worst of all is that which, while the body lies still and at rest, moves it part by means of something else. Therefore, of the modes of purifying and restoring the body, the best is that through exercise, second is that through swaying motions, as in sailing or in any other conveyance that produces no fatigue, and a third kind of motion, useful only on occasion of great necessity, but otherwise never to be accepted by a sensible person, is the medical purging brought about by drugs. For diseases that do not carry great dangers should not be provoked by medications, since every constitution of diseases bears some resemblance to the nature of living creatures. For the composition of a living being has, in a sense, fixed periods of life allotted to it, both for the species as a whole and for each individual creature, which grows with its own destined span of life, apart from those sufferings that come by necessity. For the triangles, from the very beginning, are constituted with a power in each case sufficient to last only up to a certain time, beyond which no one could ever continue to live. The same holds true of the constitution of diseases. Whenever someone destroys this, in defiance of its destined time, by means of drugs, then diseases that were small and few tend to become great and many. Hence one must manage all such conditions, so far as one has the leisure to do so, by regimen, rather than provoke a troublesome evil by drugging it. Concerning the living creature as a common whole then, and the bodily part of it, and the way in which a person might best live according to reason, both training and being trained by himself, let this be said. But that which is to do the training, the soul itself, must be prepared beforehand, and with even greater priority, to be as excellent and as fair as possible for its task of training. To go through these matters with precision would in itself be work enough for a treatise on its own. But as a subordinate matter, following the plan we have kept to so far, one might not be out of place in bringing the discussion to a close in this way, as follows. TIMAUS, as we've said many times, three kinds of soul are settled in us, in three regions, and each has its own motions. So now too, as briefly as possible, we must say this. Whichever part lives in idleness and keeps its own motions still is bound to become weakest, while the part that gets exercise becomes strongest. That's why we must watch that their motions stay in due proportion to one another. As for the ruling kind of soul in us, we should think of it this way. God has given it to each of us as a guiding spirit, this thing that we say lives in the topmost part of our body and lifts us up from earth toward our kinship in heaven, since we are a plant not of earth, but of heaven. And that's exactly right, for it is from there, from the place where the soul first came to be, that the divine suspends our head and root and keeps our whole body upright. So for a person absorbed in appetites or rivalries, working hard at those alone, all his convictions are bound to become mortal, and insofar as it's possible at all for a human being to become wholly mortal, he falls short of that not even a little, since it's exactly this side of himself he's built up. But for the person who has devoted himself to the love of learning and to true understanding, and who has exercised this part of himself above all, it's entirely necessary, if he lays hold of truth, that he think immortal and divine thoughts, and insofar as human nature admits a share in immortality, he leaves no part of that behind, and since he's always caring for the divine and keeps in good order the guiding spirit that lives within him, he is happy beyond the ordinary measure. And the one care that fits every part of us is this, to give each part the nourishment and the motions proper to it. Now the movements that are kindred to the divine element in us are the universe's own reasonings and orbits. Those are what every one of us ought to follow, setting right the circuits in our head that were thrown out of order at our birth, by coming to know the cosmos's harmonies and circling paths, and so rendering the understanding part like the thing it understands, following our original nature, and by so likening it, achieving the goal of the best life the gods have set before human beings, both for the present and for time to come. And with that, the task set for us from the start, to give an account of the universe up to the birth of human beings, has, I think, pretty much reached its end. As for how the other animals came to be, that needs only brief mention, nothing that requires dwelling on at length. That way a person may seem to himself to have kept fair proportion in his account of these matters. So let this be said on the subject. Times, of the men who were born, all those who were cowards and spent their lives unjustly were, by all reasonable account, changed into women at the second birth. And it was at that very time, for this reason, that the gods devised the desire that belongs to sexual union, fashioning one living thing, ensouled, in us, and another in women, making each of them in the following way. The channel for drink, by which the drink, passing through the lung under the kidneys into the bladder, is pressed by the breath and expelled along with it. They bored through so as to connect it to the marrow that runs, compacted, from the head down the neck, and through the spine, the very thing we earlier called seed. And this marrow, being ensouled, and having gained a means of breathing, implanted in that very place where it breathes a living desire for outflow, and so brought about the desire for begetting. This is why, in men, the part concerned with the genitals has become disobedient and self-willed, like a creature that will not listen to reason, and through its raging desires tries to master everything. And likewise in women, what are called the womb and matrix, for these same reasons, contain a creature desirous of childbearing. And whenever it goes unfruited for a long time past its season, it grows distressed and bears this badly, and wandering all through the body, blocking the passages of breath, not allowing respiration, it throws the body into the extremest straits and produces all sorts of other diseases, until the desire and love of each sex, drawing them together, as if plucking fruit from trees, so into the womb, as into a plowed field, living things invisible for their smallness and still unformed, and then, separating them out again, nourish them within to a great size, and after that, bring them to light and complete the birth of living creatures. This, then, is how women and the whole female sex came to be. And the tribe of birds was transformed, growing feathers instead of hair, out of men who were harmless but light-headed, men who studied the heavens, but in their simplicity thought that the surest proofs about such things came through sight. The land-dwelling, wild animal kind, in turn, came from men who made no use whatsoever of philosophy and gave no thought at all to the nature of the heavens, because they no longer made use of the circuits in the head, but instead followed the parts of the soul around the chest as their guides. Times, from these habits of life then, their forelimbs and heads were dragged down to the earth and fixed there by kinship with it, and their crowns were drawn out long and took on all sorts of shapes, depending on how each one's revolutions were squeezed together through disuse. It's from this cause that their kind grew four-footed and many-footed, God setting more feet under the more mindless ones, so that they might be drawn even more toward the earth. And the most mindless of these, those whose whole body is stretched out flat against the earth, as though there were no further need of feet, these the gods bred footless, writhing along the ground. The fourth kind came to live in water, born from those who were the most thoughtless and ignorant of all creatures, whose remolders no longer thought them worthy even of pure breath, on the grounds that their soul was made impure by every kind of transgression. So instead of fine, pure air to breathe, they were thrust into water, to draw a murky, deep sort of breath there. From this came the tribe of fish, and that of shellfish, and all the other creatures that live in water, having been allotted, as the penalty for their utter ignorance, the most degraded dwellings of all. And it is according to these same principles that, both then and now, living things pass back and forth into one another, changing as they lose or gain understanding, or its lack. And so let us now say that our account of the universe has, at last, reached its end. For having taken in mortal and immortal living things, and been filled up in this way, this world has come to be a visible living thing containing the visible things within it, an image of the intelligible, a perceptible God, greatest and best, most beautiful and most complete, this one heaven, being of a single kind, having come into being.
Krishas, a dialogue of Socrates with Timaeus, Krishas and Hermocrates.
How gladly, Socrates, I now find myself released from this long journey of argument, like a traveler resting at last. And to that God who existed long ago indeed, but has just now come into being in our speech, I offer this prayer, that for whatever we have said rightly, he grant us the preservation of it, and if we have said anything about him unwillingly out of tune, that he impose the fitting penalty. And the right penalty for one who strikes a false note is to be brought back into harmony. So that we may henceforth speak correctly about the birth of the gods, we ask him to give us knowledge, the most complete and best of remedies. Having prayed, we now hand over the argument to Krishas, as we agreed, to continue.
Well, Timaeus, I accept it, but the same plea you made at the outset, asking indulgence since you were about to speak of great matters, I now make again for myself, and indeed I think I deserve to receive it in even greater measure, given what I am about to say. And yet I know pretty well that what I am about to ask forgiveness for is rather too ambitious, even ill-mannered for the occasion, but it must be said all the same. Who in his right mind would try to argue that what you have said was not said well, but that what is about to be said needs even more indulgence, since it is more difficult, this I must try somehow to show. Speaking about the gods to human beings, Timaeus, seems easier to bring off convincingly than speaking about mortal things to us. For the inexperience and sheer ignorance of an audience about matters, they know nothing of gives great freedom to anyone who means to speak about them, and we know exactly how we stand regarding the gods. But to make what I mean clearer, follow me this way. Everything said by any of us must, I suppose, amount to imitation and representation. Consider, then, the image-making of painters, when they represent divine and human bodies. How easy or difficult it is to satisfy viewers that they have imitated well enough. We will see that in the case of earth, mountains, rivers, forest, and the whole sky with everything moving in it, we are content first, if someone is able to reproduce even a small resemblance of them, and further, since we have no exact knowledge of such things, we neither examine nor test what is painted, but make do with a vague and misleading sketch of them. But when someone attempts to depict our own human bodies, we notice sharply what is left out, because of our constant familiarity with them, and we become harsh critics of anyone who fails to render every last likeness. We must recognize the same thing happening in speeches. We are satisfied with accounts of heavenly and divine things even when only slightly plausible, but we scrutinize mortal and human things with precision. So if, speaking on the spur of the moment now, we cannot render everything fittingly, you must forgive us. For mortal things are not easy but difficult to represent to your satisfaction, and that is how you should think of it. Wanting to remind you of this, Socrates, and asking not less but more indulgence for what is about to be said, I have said all this. If it seems to you that I ask for this gift justly, grant it willingly.
Why should we not grant it, Krishas? And let this same gift be given, as a third installment, by us to Hermocrates as well. For it's clear that shortly, when his turn comes to speak, he will ask the same indulgence you have, so that he may find a fresh opening and not be forced to repeat the same one. Let him assume the forgiveness is already his when the time comes, and speak accordingly. I warn you now, dear Krishas, of how the audience will take it. The poet who went before you was remarkably well received by them. So you will need a very great deal of indulgence if you are to be able to take up the subject after him.
You are giving me, Socrates, the very same warning you give him.
But men who lose heart, Krishas, have never yet raised a victory trophy. So you must go forward into your speech bravely, and calling upon Payan and the Muses, show forth and celebrate the ancient citizens as the good men they were.
Dear Hermocrates, stationed as you are in the rear rank with another before you, you can still afford courage. How this will actually go, the event itself will soon show you. Still, I must be persuaded by your comfort and encouragement, and besides the gods you named, I must call on the others, and especially memory. For nearly everything of greatest importance in our account depends on this goddess. If we can recall and report adequately what was once told by the priests and brought here by Solon, I am fairly confident we will seem to this audience to have discharged our task reasonably well. So this must now be done, and no more delay. First of all, let us recall that the sum total was 9,000 years since the war was reported to have occurred between those who dwelt beyond the pillars of Heracles and all who dwelt within, a war we must now trace through. Of the one side, this very city was said to have led and fought the whole war through. Of the other side, the kings of the island of Atlantis, which we said was once larger than Libya and Asia together, but now, sunk by earthquakes, has left an impassable mud that blocks any who sail out from here into the open sea, so that no one can pass through any longer. The many barbarian peoples, and whatever Greek nations existed then, our account will reveal each in turn as the story unwinds and comes upon them. But the Athenians of that time and their opponents, whom they fought, we must first go through at the outset, describing the power and constitution of each. Of these, it is right to give precedence to our own side. Long ago, the gods divided up the whole earth among themselves by region, not through strife, for it would not be reasonable to suppose the gods ignorant of what was fitting for each of them, or that, knowing what was more properly another's, they would try to seize it for themselves through quarreling. Receiving their fair portions by the allotments of justice, they settled the various lands, and having settled them, they reared us, their own possessions and creatures, as a shepherd tends his flock, though not by forcing bodies with bodies as herdsmen drive their cattle with blows, but guiding the most tractable part of the living creature from the stern, as with a rudder laying hold of the soul by persuasion according to their own purpose, and so steering and guiding the whole mortal race. Different gods, then, took charge and ordered their own regions in different places, but Hephaestus and Athena, sharing a common nature, both as sister and brother from the same father and as united in their love of wisdom and love of craft, both received this land as their single common portion, since it was naturally suited to virtue and wisdom and being their own. Making good men to spring from its very soil, they set in their minds the order of a constitution. Of these men the names have been preserved, but their deeds have vanished, owing to the destructions suffered by those who came after and the length of the ages. For the race that always survived was left, as was said before, in the mountains, illiterate, having heard only the names of the rulers in the land and a little of their deeds besides. So they gave these names fondly to their children, but knew nothing of the virtues and laws of those who came before, except for some dim and scattered reports about each, and being themselves in want of life's necessities for many generations and their children after them, having their minds fixed on what they lacked, they made their conversation about these needs and neglected what had happened long before in earlier times. For storytelling about the past and inquiry into antiquity come to cities together with leisure, and only once people see that the necessities of life have already been secured for some, not before. This is how the names of the ancients, without their deeds, have been preserved. I say this, inferring it from the fact that Solon said the priests, in recounting that war, mentioned most of the names we still remember from before the time of Theseus, such as Cecrops, Erechtheus, Erichthonius, Eurysichthon, and the rest, applying these names mostly to the deeds of those ancient men, and likewise with the names of the women. And indeed the figure and image of the goddess, since warfare was then a shared practice for both women and men alike, shows that in accordance with that custom the goddess was dedicated armed, as a sign to those of that time that every kind of creature living together, whether female or male, is naturally capable of practicing in common the excellence proper to its kind. Now at that time the other classes of citizens in this land were occupied with crafts and with the produce of the earth, but the warrior class had been set apart from the beginning by godlike men and lived separately, having everything needed for their upbringing and education, none of them possessing anything private, but considering everything common to all of them and claiming nothing beyond sufficient sustenance from the rest of the citizens, and practicing all the customs described yesterday concerning our proposed guardians. And indeed what was said about our land was plausible and true. First, that its boundaries at that time reached to the isthmus, and on the mainland side extended as far as the heights of Citharan and Parnes, the boundary descending with Oropia on the right and marking off the Esopus on the left toward the sea. And that in excellence it surpassed every other land so that it was able at that time to support a great army, exempt from the labors of the soil. And here is great evidence of its excellence. What remains of it now can rival any land for yielding every kind of produce and abundant grazing for all creatures. But then, besides its beauty, it bore these things in vast quantity. How can this be believed, and in what sense could what remains rightly be called a remnant of that land? The whole of it juts out from the rest of the continent far into the sea like a headland, and the basin of the sea around it happens to be everywhere deep close to shore. Since then many great floods have occurred in the 9,000 years, for that is the number of years since that time to now. The soil in these times and disasters, flowing down from the heights, has not built up any noteworthy deposit as in other places, but has been carried around in a circle and disappeared into the depths. What is left, then, as happens on small islands, is like the bones of a body wasted by disease compared to what was there before, the rich soft earth having all washed away, and only the thin frame of the land remaining. But at that time, being undamaged, it had high hills where there is now bare rock, and what are now called stony plains were then full of rich soil, and it had abundant timber in its mountains, of which clear evidence remains even now. For there are mountains that today provide sustenance for nothing but bees, but it is not so very long ago that timbers cut from trees there, grown for roofing the largest buildings, still stand sound. And there were many other tall cultivated trees as well, and the land bore boundless pasture for cattle. And moreover, it enjoyed the yearly rainfall from Zeus, not lost as now by running off the bare earth into the sea, but received in abundance into the soil itself, stored up in a layer of clay that held it, releasing the water absorbed from the heights into the hollows, and so supplying every region with generous springs and rivers, of which even now, at what were once their sources, sacred shrines remain as evidence that what is now said about the land is true. This, then, is how the rest of the country naturally stood, and it had been arranged as one would expect by farmers who were true to their calling and devoted to it alone, lovers of beauty and naturally gifted, possessing the best soil, the most abundant water, and above the land the most temperate climate. And the city was settled in that time in the following way. First, the Acropolis was not then as it is now. As things stand today, a single night of extraordinary rain has stripped it bare, washing away its soil, when earthquakes struck together with a monstrous flood of water, the third such disaster before the one in Deucalion's time. But in that earlier age, in a different time altogether, it was large, reaching out to the Eridanus and the Ilysus, and enclosing within itself the Pnyx, with Lycabettus as its boundary on the side opposite the Pnyx. The whole of it was covered in soil, and apart from a small part, flat on top. The outer slopes, just below its edges, were inhabited by the craftsmen and by those farmers who worked the neighboring land. But the upper part was occupied by the warrior class alone, settled by itself around the sanctuary of Athena and Hephaestus, as if it were the single garden of a single house, all enclosed within one wall. On the northern side they had built common dwellings and winter mess halls, along with everything else needed for their communal way of life in the way of buildings and temples, but none of it in gold or silver, for they made no use of those metals anywhere. Instead, aiming for a mean between extravagance and meanness, they built themselves modest houses, in which they and their children's children grew old together and handed the same houses down, generation after generation, to others just like themselves. On the southern side, they gave up their gardens, gymnasia, and mess halls for summer use, and made use of the space for those purposes instead. There was a single spring where the Acropolis now stands. It was quenched by the earthquakes, and only small trickles remain scattered around it today,
but back then it supplied all of them with abundant water, being well-tempered for both winter and summer. In this fashion they lived, guardians of their own citizens and, by the citizens' willing consent, leaders of the rest of the Greeks, always taking the greatest care to keep their numbers, men and women alike, those still fit to bear arms and those not yet constant across time, at around 20,000 in all. Such then were these people, and in some such manner did they govern with justice both their own land and the whole of Greece, and throughout Europe and Asia they were renowned and celebrated above all others of that time for the beauty of their bodies and for every kind of excellence of soul. As for those who made war against them and how that war began, provided our memory does not fail us of what we heard as children, we will now set it out in full and share it with all of you, our friends, as common property. There is one more thing I should explain before I go on, so that you won't be puzzled at hearing so many Greek names attached to foreign men. You'll learn the reason for it. Solon, since he intended to make use of the story in his own poetry, inquired carefully into the meaning of the names, and found that the Egyptians who first wrote them down had translated them into their own language. He in turn took the sense of each name and rendered it into our language as he wrote it out. These very writings were kept by my grandfather and are still in my possession today, and I studied them closely as a boy. So if you hear names of the sort used here, let there be no wonder in it. You now know the reason. The long story, as it was told then, began roughly as follows. As was said earlier concerning the allotment of the gods, how they divided the whole earth among themselves, some receiving larger portions and others smaller, and set up temples and sacrifices for themselves. In just this way Poseidon, having received the island of Atlantis as his portion, settled there the children he had fathered on a mortal woman, in a certain part of the island of the following kind. Facing the sea, but at the center of the whole island, there lay a plain said to be the most beautiful and fertile of all plains, and near the middle of that plain, about 50 stads inland, stood a low hill. On this hill lived one of the men born there in the earliest days from the earth itself, named Evener, who dwelt there with his wife Leucip. They had a single daughter, Clato. When the girl had reached marriageable age, her mother and father died, and Poseidon, falling in love with her, had union with her. He took the hill where she had lived and fortified it, cutting it off all around, forming alternating rings of sea and land encircling one another, smaller and larger by turns, two of land and three of sea, as if turning them on a lathe from the center of the island, each ring equally distant from the next, so that no man could reach it, for ships and sailing did not yet exist. He himself, being a god, readily adorned the island at its center, bringing up two springs of water from below the earth, one warm, and a separate cold one flowing from a spring, and bringing forth from the earth every kind of nourishment, abundant and various. He fathered five pairs of male twins and raised them, and having divided the whole island of Atlantis into 10 parts, he gave to the firstborn of the eldest pair his mother's dwelling and the surrounding allotment, the largest and best of all, and made him king over the rest. The others he made rulers as well, giving each one authority over many people and a large territory to govern. He gave names to them all. To the eldest, the king, he gave the name from which the whole island and the surrounding sea took their title, called Atlantic, because the first king's name at that time was Atlas. To the twin born next after him, who received as his portion the outer end of the island toward the pillars of Heracles, facing the region now called the land of Gadara, named after that place, he gave the name Eumelus in Greek, and in the native tongue Gadarus, which is presumably the origin of that region's name. Of the second pair, he named one Amphers and the other Evemen. Of the third pair, the elder was named Nessius, and the one after him Autochthon. Of the fourth pair, the elder was Elasippus, the younger Mester. And of the fifth pair, the elder was named Azes, and the younger Diapreps. All these men, and their descendants after them, ruled for many generations, holding power over many other islands throughout that sea, and also, as was said before, over the peoples within the strait as far as Egypt and Tyrrhenia. Now Atlas fathered a great and honored line, and the eldest king always passed the kingship down to the eldest of his descendants, preserving it through many generations, having amassed wealth so vast that no dynasty of kings had ever possessed the like before, nor is it likely that any ever will again. and they had everything prepared for them that it was possible to provide, both in the city and throughout the rest of the land. Much flowed to them from abroad because of their power, but the island itself supplied most of what was needed for daily life. First, all the solid and fusible materials that can be dug from mines, including that metal which is now only a name but was then something more, the ore called orichalcum, dug up in many parts of the island, and at that time valued above everything except gold. It also provided, in abundance, all the timber needed for the work of carpenters, and pastured a sufficient number of tame and wild animals of every kind.